You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our special guest today is Susan Dworkin. She is the author of several biographies and has written extensively for magazines, including Ms. and Cosmopolitan. Her fascination with agriculture dates from early stints at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and as a journalist covering aid programs in the Middle East. She currently lives in New York City and the Berkshires and is here to talk about her newest book, Viking in the Wheat Field. It has been called an illuminating biography of Bent Skovmand, a prescient Scandinavian and U of M alumnus who devoted his career to amassing, categorizing, and genetically developing a global seed bank that could save the world from famine. There's lots of fun U of M connections. Norman Borlaug is in here, the University of Minnesota's cereal disease lab, and other interesting scientific things that Susan makes very, very compelling. So please join me. She's going to talk about her book, then she'll take questions from the audience, and then she'll sign copies. Please welcome Susan Dworkin.
Thank you. Since this is a small group, I think that I'm going to dispense with notes and just talk a little bit about this book. I am not a scientist. I am a cultural historian and a biographer. I've written a lot of biographies of different kinds of people, beauty queens and refugees and Ryan White's mother. Anybody remember Ryan White? The boy, the first case of pediatric AIDS. The AIDS bill is named for him. Boy from rural Indiana, a hemophiliac, was the first, got thrown out of school, thrown out of his community. So I have a fairly wide range in terms of the kinds of people I've written about. Bent Skovmand was on my mind for 15 years. I read about him in Time magazine, I think in the 90s. Then I read about him in the New York Times. And I kept saying to myself, one of these days when I get past the documentary that I'm making for Ms. Magazine or the book that I'm writing about some actress or the speech that I'm writing for some politician, I'm going to interview Bent Skovmand. And then one day I opened the paper and he was gone. I saw this huge obituary in the Times. And I had this moment of truth, you know, like, you've wasted your life, you haven't done the things you really wanted to do, terrible. And the next day, when I was recovered from the blues, I called Richard Zion, who was mentioned in the obituary, who was a professor in the plant pathology department at this great university. And I said, Dr. Zion, you don't know me, but I am very interested in this man, and I wonder if there's any way for me to meet his wife and to talk to her and other members of his family. And what ensued was this extraordinary odyssey. I spoke to his wife, his second wife, her name is Eugenia. Eugenia, we would see. Eugenia, she's from Mexico. And she was living in Sweden. And her kids, one child was in Argentina, and one child was in Florida, and she had two children that were with her in Sweden. And I ended up making an exclusive arrangement with her for access to his papers. And I went to Sweden, and I went to Denmark, and then I went to his seed bank in Mexico. And then I went to California and interviewed a great many of his colleagues at the University of California in Davis, and now I'm here. And I will tell you, besides Barb, who I know knew him, are there others here who were friends or colleagues of Bent Skovmand? Do you know who he was, what he did? Bent Skovmand was the leading, I think without a doubt, the leading gene seed banker in the United States, in North America. He was the creator of the single greatest collection of wheat in the world. This was a collection of wheat that was held in Mexico at the Center for the Improvement of Maize and Wheat near Texcoco, which we call by its Spanish acronym CIMMET. He was an exchange student who came over with the Minnesota MAST program from Denmark and worked on a farm in Minnesota, a farm belonging to some people named Grant and Esther Lee. He came from he came from Funen near Odense, and his father was a preacher. There were no other big intellectuals in his family. It's so interesting how some people with absolutely no particular intellectual academic background emerge as professors and experts in their field, writers. He came over to this country in the late 60s, and he was inspired by the Scandinavian pioneers of the UN, Trygve Lie and Dag Hammarskjöld. He was very inspired by John Kennedy, as I was. We are contemporaries, me and the late Dr. Skovmann. What can you do for your country? What can you do for the world? Don't ask what it can do for you, ask what you can do for. You know, that has become a very, very stale phrase. But I assure you, as one who graduated college in 1962, that it was very meaningful for my generation, and it pointed us in certain directions that we wouldn't have taken in another era. Anyway, Bent had it in his mind that he was interested in being around people who would save the world and improve the quality of the human race. And he came to Minnesota, he worked on this farm, and he had come from a family that wasn't, I know you met his mother. He thought that he was his mother's least favorite child. He had the feeling he was his mother's least favorite child. It was not a warm situation for him at home. And when he got to the Lees, they had two daughters, and they treated him like a surrogate son, and they adored him. He cleaned out the pig pens, and he drove the tractor, and he did all the stuff you do on farms. And they were crazy about him, and he returned their affection. The MAST program, the Minnesota Agricultural Student Trainee Program, is one of the most successful of its kind in the country. And if you got into this program, you could matriculate into the university, which is what Bent did. He got here. He didn't have any money. He got here from Denmark because he got an $860 scholarship from the Tuborg Brewery. And his brother said he got on the boat, it was a boat, and he never looked back. And we knew he was gone forever, that Denmark was too small for him, and the family was too tight for him, and the whole monocultural quality of life in that country didn't suit him. We got to America, this I'm quoting now his brother, with its freedom to speak and its open academic system and its everybody gets a shot kind of philosophy, he felt that he was really at home. Well, he gets to the University of Minnesota in 1970, which was the year that there was a lot going on here because Norman Borlaug won the Nobel Prize. And so the university was filled with a sense of triumph and victory, and particularly the plant pathology department and CFANS. I don't think it was CFANS yet. And he came and he in 6 years, he had a PhD. And there was a fellow here named Elvin Charles Stakeman, who was the mentor of Borlaug, of Norman Borlaug, who was really one of the great powers in American agriculture in the early part of this century. And Dr. Stakeman, if he saw a talented person, he would push them into positions and into jobs where they could be helpful to each other. You know, it's true that this happens, I think, with charismatic professors. Those of you who are charismatic professors will know what I'm talking about. There's a guy at Williams, a professor of art history at Williams, who teaches art history, and now six of the major curators of the major collections in this country were his students. This happens. Stakeman was one of those people. So he had gotten Borlaug, Stakeman had gotten Borlaug to go to Mexico and start a new program to develop maize and wheat, particularly wheat, And the Rockefeller Foundation was the money behind it, and Stakeman had gotten one of his students to be involved with the Rockefeller Foundation. So it was a network of people who were involved in the great work of the day, which was to somehow or another feed the starving. Because in the wake of the Second World War, it became apparent that famine was a regular occurrence, that it was not something that happened over there. There was no more over there after the Second World War. The war had shrunk. And if there was going to be famine and millions of people were going to die in India, we were going to know about it. There was no hiding the developing world anymore. It was an emerging world. And the catastrophes of the developing world, which often had to do with desperate hunger, terrible soil, awful governments that didn't know how to allot money or water or resources, awful crookocracies of local thugs who would victimize people. There was so much trouble in countries like that, that famine, which is the result of mismanagement as well as bad weather, famine was a regular occurrence. And everybody at CIMMYT in Mexico, which was being run by Borlaug, everybody at CIMMYT was there to develop kinds of wheat and kinds of seed that would then somehow or another be useful in the developing world and stave off the regular catastrophe of famine. So you have to understand why all these people went to Mexico, Skovmand and many others. And he took his family, and he went to work for Norman Borlaug in the Triticale fields of Obregon. They got up at 4:30 in the morning. They hit the fields at 5. Borlaug was already there. He would shine his headlights on the field and make selections. He got there before anybody. There were Mexican scientists who felt that they were quite superior to the workers and that they would direct the workers and the workers would work. But you couldn't do that with Borlaug. Borlaug said, you're going to work with me. You're going to get in the field, get your hands dirty, get in the dirt and do the work. So the local customs that he didn't like, he didn't have any respect for. He was very disrespectful. And he bowled them over. One of the people that I interviewed said that Norman Borlaug was a damn the torpedoes kind of guy, that he would look around for the best equipment, get the best price, not ask permission, buy what he needed and send in the bill. You know. And Dr. Stakeman's friends at the Rockefeller Foundation paid. Anyway, Bent Skovmand basically lost his first family. I think that's right, it's a lady who knows him, in Mexico under these terrible circumstances where he was absent, his daughter told me, 4 to 6 months of the year. And he was not alone. He was not alone. Borlaug really demanded a tremendous amount of self-sacrifice from the people who worked for him and others who were there also. Their wives left them. They said, I'm not going to hang out in this place with you. You know, you're up in some field. I never see you. So long, buddy. And they were out of there. These were mostly American women who weren't going to put up with this kind of thing. Ultimately, Skovmand remarried a Mexican woman who was quite a bit younger than he. And she was the one with whom I made, and she lived with him for 26 years. They had a couple of kids. And she was the one who went everywhere in the world with him and was the source of all the information that is in this book. So what's the information? I'm going to read you, in order to explain to you what a seed banker is and what seed banking, how important it is in the world we live in. I want to read you just a little section here. It's pretty short. And if I can get my glasses on, it'll help. Hang on. Here we go. This will sort of put you in the picture. When I say Bent Skovmand was the world's leading seed banker, this will put you in the picture of what exactly that means, okay? The UN says there will be 9 billion people on Earth by 2050. They will need a 75% increase in food. That is more food than the world has eaten in the last 10,000 years. How can this unprecedented demand be met when just about every good acre is already under cultivation? Already close to 1 billion people go hungry already. 25,000 people die of starvation every day. To create more fields, we'd have to destroy more forest, in particular, tropical rainforest, with all the attendant peril that poses for the world's oxygen supply. And what about the flora and the fauna? The International Union for the Conservation of Nature says that 1 out of 4 mammals is heading for extinction, and hundreds of them in our lifetime, and 70% of the world's plants are scheduled for the same fate. What do we do about this catastrophe? Well, surely the farmers can tell us. But how many of us know a farmer to ask? Now, remember, I wrote this book. I'm talking to you guys in Minnesota, but I wrote this book for New Yorkers. I wrote this book for people from Connecticut and people from Los Angeles, and I assure you, they do not know a farmer to ask. The information gulf between the urban and suburban and rural people of this country is so huge now that if you recall the presidential debates between McCain and Obama, farming, the agricultural sector, wasn't ever even mentioned. It wasn't mentioned. It's as though those 3% of the farms that produce 75% of the food are in a different country. And the vast body of Americans doesn't have to know anything about them. Now, thankfully, certain people like the New York Times, Michael Pollan, few people have tried to overcome this gulf. But it remains, and it's very serious. This is what Skovmund said about the basic problem of agriculture. And if you get this, then you get the whole deal. He said that this is at a speech in Minnesota. He said, poets and city folk love to romanticize agriculture. They portray it as some sort of idyllic state of harmony between humankind and nature. That is absolutely true. People in urban areas completely romanticize agriculture. They forget that it's backbreaking work. They think, you know, the birds are singing, the wheat is rustling. Meanwhile, another group of futuristic folk think that agriculture is a sunset industry and soon food will be produced in a slurry of kitchen waste through bacterial fermentation. That's the people who made Avatar. How far from the truth are both viewpoints, since Neolithic man, or more likely woman, domesticated crops about 10,000 years ago? Agriculture, this is what Skovmund said, has been a struggle between the forces of natural biodiversity and the need to produce food under increasingly intensive production systems. Monoculture, growing one kind of food, is very good for business. It is very, very bad for nature. It is very, very bad for humanity. But if you need to produce more food for humanity, how can you do that? What's the best way to do that? Best way, the most efficient way, the most business-like way is monoculture. So what do? He had put his finger precisely on the central problem of progress in agriculture. To wrest greater quantities of food from a wheat field, you need to breed varieties that give you the greatest yield. To be successful, your breeding program needs a large, diverse gene pool, which gives you lots of choices. But when you finally come up with the most bountiful wheat, all the farmers plant it. You can't blame monoculture. I had this conversation yesterday with somebody. You can't blame monoculture on Monsanto. You can't blame it on BASF. The farmers are not very interested in growing a diverse selection of crops. They want to grow what's going to bring them the best price in the marketplace. All the farmers plant the preferred variety. Therefore, when you need to breed a new variety because the favored one just became stressed by bad weather or killer disease like rust, there's less diversity remaining in the gene pool on which to base your search for a solution. Repeat that scenario many times, and soon so little diversity remains that breeding better wheat is almost impossible. It's like deliberate programmed forgetting. Apply it to the glory of Greece and Rome, and you get the Dark Ages. apply it to agriculture, and you get famine, migrations of hungry people searching for food, and inevitably war. There's only one way to keep up with the need to eat, and that is for scientists to constantly rebreed the harvest to grow in greater abundance. To do that without imperiling the very biodiversity that makes breeding possible requires what? That scientists collect and conserve the material from which the new wheat varieties are created. That's a seed bank. That's what Ben Skovman did. He worked at the heart of the partnership between the field where the wheat grows and the lab in which the wheat's traits are investigated and the gene bank in which all its ancestors and relatives are maintained and increased. I read you that little piece of this book because I don't think that what gene banking is really understood. It is the thing that a very few people do. In the case of wheat, then crops in this country, 2,000 people, an estimate of 2,000 people, are in the seed banking business. Their network of seed banks, we call it the National Plant Germplasm System in this country, that network stands between us and starvation, literally. If we don't have all those genes and that gene pool collected, we haven't got what to breed from. So when the weather changes because of global warming, and it is changing no matter what anybody says, it is getting hotter and the water's getting saltier, all kinds of things are happening. When the crops are threatened by something new, like global warming, the people up at the cereal disease lab in St. Paul on the other campus, they go to work hunting for genes that they can put into the wheat and into the corn and into the sorghum that will protect the crop against the new weather, drought, saline water, new bugs that are rising in response to the new weather, which is happening all the time, prolonged freezing, which is happening all the time, shortened days, daylight, less daylight, which is happening all the time. All the things, they call these abiotic stresses because they haven't got to do with bugs and soil. They have to do with rain and sun. It's impossible to keep the crops constant and up to date and healthy without these gene banks. At the moment, nobody knows they exist. They are dramatically underfunded. The National Plant Germplasm System in this country, which is a wonderful system. It's got like apples in New York and potatoes in Wisconsin and rice somewhere in the South. It's an extraordinary system of crop special crop collections. The wheat collections in Idaho, we call it the small grains collections. It's got barley and oats, wheat. That particular system is a subdivision of the Agricultural Research Service, which is a department of the USDA. When it comes to the Farm Bill, who lobbies for that? Who thinks of it? You got to get your act together and fight for these things. And the reason I wrote this book was because I am acutely aware, and have been since I was a young girl, first working for the USDA, that it takes more than the farm belt to make a farm program work. There has to be a large, non-farm, civic voice that supports good programs in the farm belt. We are one country. You can't say those 3% of the people who are growing 75% of the food are on their own. They need the New Yorkers. They need the people from Connecticut and vice versa. So that when I sat down to write about the National Plant Germplasm System, I was really trying to inform people who are interested. They're interested, but they don't get the information. I was trying to bring it in a readable way to people who never get to understand what really goes on in the farm and what the basic motor of agriculture is. So that's the story. If you have any questions, I'd be delighted to take them. If anybody wants to discuss, yes.
What did he say about the effect of the genetically modified plants contaminating the seed bank, possibly, and especially now that they're just going to get in corn that's been genetically modified, that's just been allowed into Mexico, you know, and the Roundup Ready and all these other things which drift on the wind?
I tell you, it's very interesting. This is a very interesting question. Genetic modification means you put something in the plant that's not there, or naturally, right? You mix the plant with another kind of plant, or you mix it with a chemical. The corporations who have made great fortunes, like Monsanto and BASF and Syngenta, they do chemicals. They were all chemical companies. Dow, DuPont, they were all chemical companies initially. They all, that's who runs the seed business. And Bent Skovmand used to say, if we're not careful, four or five companies are going to control the seed supply of the entire world. On the other hand, he was not against genetic modification of plants by plants, even if they were from different genera. For example, there's something in this world called golden rice. Have you ever heard of this, golden rice? Golden rice has got vitamin A put into it from daffodils. That's a genetically modified crop. Skovmand worked for years on triticale, which is a combination of wheat and rye, too. They may look alike, but they're not the same genera. They are two different plants. He had nothing against that kind of genetic modification. But to tell you the truth, it never occurred to him, because he was so convinced of the purposefulness of what he was doing, it never occurred to him that some evil person or some lunatic would get hold of this technology. And of course, that's the problem. The problem is that there's a gene for breast cancer and somebody might own it. That's the problem. The problem that Skovmand saw was not really a botanical or physiological problem. It had to do with commerce and the way the United States particularly has organized the commerce in crop seeds. In 1980, the Supreme Court laid down a decision that said it was all right for people to produce and own the elements of life, patent the elements of life. Do you know the background of this? It's very interesting because it had to do with oil spills. There were some terrible oil spills in the late 70s. One was in the Gulf of Mexico. It was a nightmare. It was like 10 times worse than the Exxon Valdez. And there was a guy named Chakrabarty who worked for General Electric. And he had developed a bacteria, invented a bacteria that was so programmed that maybe if you put it on the oil spill, it was like Miss Pac-Man. It would digest the oil. Possibly. There was a shot, a good chance. For 8 years, this application for a patent was in the courts. 1980, there was this horrendous oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and the Supreme Court said, okay, let's give it a shot. And that was what empowered, that act of the Supreme Court was what really began what you're talking about, this huge increment in corporations patenting seeds and patenting microbes and patenting genes. Skovmand said that he was very much against it. He saw no way to turn it back. He could not figure out how you could stop it once it had started. But he said that patenting seeds was like patenting every word in Hamlet. Every time you said a word from Hamlet, you had to pay Shakespeare, like two, that's a nickel, B, that's a nickel. Or that's another nickel. It was a very apt metaphor, because in fact, farmers pay seed by seed every time they use a Monsanto seed or a Dow seed. They pay. Now, nobody's forcing them to pay. They pay because it profits them. the Brazilians have built themselves into a world power on the back of Roundup Ready soybeans. There's, you know, you can't separate one thing from another. And you cannot say to the farmer, I don't think you can say to the farmer, you sacrifice your profit in order to plant seeds that we think are better. And we don't want you to buy this stuff because, you know, we don't like it. We think it's screwing up the genome. We think it's lousing up the American agricultural fields. It's very hard to say to the farmers that. They won't listen.
But could it contaminate the seed banks? Or are they all
the seed banks are kept pretty much free of genetic modification. And the reason is, the other side, the upside of patenting, is that the corporations who own those seeds don't want to share them. They don't want them in the seed bank with Bent Skovman handing them out, because that's what he did. He handed his seed bank. If there was something you wanted from his seed bank, you got it for free. You got it for the cost of the FedEx. The only cost was that when you got through growing your wheat with the seed that he gave you, you had to send back a sample to the seed bank so the next guy would have the benefit of what you had learned breeding that new wheat. So it was a dynamic and populist kind of effort. It was aimed at helping people, be independent, at helping countries be independent, because this was not a matter of exporting crops. This was a matter of exporting knowledge, of exporting seed that then you could turn into your own crop. And it was the basis for the Green Revolution, which Norman Borlaug started, and Skovmund became the central librarian for all the wheat breeders in the world. He really did quite a job. Toward the end of his, he died in 2007, the last couple of years before he died, there were huge funding changes in the world of agricultural research, and the CIMMYT organization nearly went broke, and they laid off. First, they laid off all the workers in the seed bank. It broke his heart. Then they laid off a lot of the scientists. And he was knighted by the Queen of Denmark for service to humanity. And the next month, he was fired, along with dozens of other very priceless and vital scientists. And he went to work for the Nordic Gene Bank, and they developed there something which you may have actually heard of, called the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, otherwise known as the Doomsday Vault. You heard of this thing? It's up on the northern border of Norway in the Arctic Circle. And I leave you with this thought, that as wonderful it is, as it is that all the world's countries have stored their seeds, their crop seeds, in the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, down under 400 feet of permafrost and rock, as wonderful as that is, it goes to show you how scared everybody is that a great catastrophe will befall this world and require us to begin agriculture all over again. And if you ever doubt what Al Gore has to say or Jim Hansen has to say about global warming, that catastrophe is not nuclear war. That's not what they're thinking of. They're thinking about the tidal waves and the earthquakes and the terrible heat that was in Australia last year that has come to dominate a world in which is doomed to have terrible climate catastrophes unless we somehow or another figure out how to stem and stop this tide. So that is Dr. Skovmund. He was a great alumnus of the University of Minnesota. Those of you who are associated with the school should be very, very proud of him. And it was a pleasure to write about him and meet all the people who knew him. Thank you.
Have you presented this over on the St. Paul campus where there's more people who have some technical training and appreciation for what's in this book versus this part of the university?
Well, you know, the truth is this book is for this part of the campus, but yes, the answer is that tomorrow I will be there in Cargill Hall. It's free. I'm coming in. It's a much more detailed presentation, and there will be a panel as well as me, which includes, I think, Les Szabo from the Serial Disease Lab, and Carol Ishimura, and Richard Zion. So, and maybe a couple of other people who I don't know yet, but real experts who will be able to fill you in on what's going on currently in research in this university. But the truth is, this book is, I think one lady already read it, is written, it's not that it's unscientific. Believe me, the scientists signed off on it. I made sure of that. But it is supposed to be readable. It is supposed to bring people to this subject who've never read a book about this subject. So I hope that it does that.
Great job on it.
Thank you. Take care. It's a pleasure.
My favorite line in there, as far as a humorous line, is I love the part where he wanted to use triticale in making tacos, and it just wasn't going over.
Do you know there's something that the New York actors who do television ads, they call it a bite and smile. Like, this is when you're supposed to, you bite the thing, and you move them. That's what he would do with triticale. Triticale taco did not fly.